For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Sometimes here we chant a sutra called the difference or the harmony of difference and sameness, and of course, as the sutra indicates, difference and sameness are not exclusive. They each fully express each other. They require each other. As we say in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Nonetheless, there is a tendency, I think, and maybe it's just how I hear things, to speak a little bit more often in situations like this about sameness, emptiness. And today, I'd like to speak a little bit, put a little bit more emphasis on difference and particularity, all those kinds of words, even though every time you say either one of them, they're both fully there. It was hard to know what to talk about here. I mean, it seems like a natural kind of thing would be to talk about this recent experience that I've shared with many here. Getting ordained. But as I was trying to think about that, it was like both kind of too big. I'm taking in certain aspects of that, and will be, I think, probably from now on, and also too small and kind of too not much to say about it, because it's just a consequence of, you know, what my life happens to be on this particular day, in this particular time and place. So then I started thinking, well, you know, maybe some part of that. So part of that ceremony is, you know, we receive from our teacher, Theokesa, and we receive our bowls, we receive new names, we receive lineage papers, and all of these things have this kind of, a lot can be said about all of them. They all have this very sort of, they have, among other things, this, a communicative function. There's a way in which, through these things, the tradition that we're part of speaks to us very directly, and we speak to each other about that tradition. But again, it's like, you know, it's going to take me a while to really understand how these things work, of course. So I kind of kept narrowing it down and narrowing it down. I said, well, what don't people talk about very often? And I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about Okesa envelopes. So I'm going to talk about the Okesa envelope. And I'm also going to talk about rocks and little stones. And there's a reason I'm going to talk about them together. And the reason is, you know, I'll just give a little introduction about this particular Okesa envelope, and then I'll speak to it later. But this used to belong to Hogetsu. And it came into my hands in a way that I'll explain later. And because my Okesa is a little bit bigger, it's based on the measurements of these fingers, and so it doesn't quite fit. It fits pretty well, but not quite so well. So it's high. So the former attachment didn't fit anymore, and I'm going to have to find something to put there. Right now I've got a safety pin. And I thought, well, what I would like to find, I remember that somewhere, I haven't located it yet, somewhere I have a nice little stone with a hole in it. And so I thought, well, I can make a little loop and, you know, tie some, you know, something through that hole in the stone, drop that through, and it would attach, you know. And so then I started thinking about these little rocks and things, little rocks and pieces of glass. And I thought that, it, you know, there's actually some significance to, for me, to the fact that I remember this particular little stone, even though I don't know where it is. I'm sure that many people have the experience, you know, they pick up little things, stones, shells, pieces of glass, and I've been in the habit of doing that for a long time. Like if I'm hiking somewhere, for example, or if I'm in a new place, for some reason it's always just been a very natural thing for me to do to pick up a rock or something, and with no particular intention. And sometimes, you know, I always think, oh, I'm going to remember this one. I'm going to remember this time, this place, with the help of the stone. And sometimes I do. I mean, you know, this is from the White Mountains in New Hampshire. It's kind of like a Vajra thunderbolt. But a lot of times I don't. You know, I can't, you know, there are too many. But I do, you know, I do oftentimes it's like recognizing a face. So it's like I can find things and it's like, ah, you know, this one, I wish you could see it. You know, I don't remember where it came from, but I remember it. I remember it specifically. And, you know, I'd see it every couple of years. And therefore, I know I have this one. I'm going to find it. I'm going to attach it to my acacia. It's going to be really nice. And but I started thinking about what, well, okay. So I always had, you know, this penchant for picking up the occasional rock or whatever. But I haven't always had, you know, this much stuff. This much stuff, and this is part of it because, you know, I've got this other stash somewhere that's got this one I'm looking for in it. This comes from a particular interaction that I had with a friend of mine some time ago. This was a girl named Lucia, and she was 8 at the time, and she was the daughter of a woman that I had been going out with in those years. And one of the things that Lucia really liked to do was to go to, you know, the lakefront and, you know, and pick up rocks, you know, and look at them. And she would, you know, she would show them to people and, you know, she would collect them. She'd have a pile and always, and some would go home, some wouldn't. But, you know, so we found that that was something we enjoyed doing together. And, you know, and so I kind of got into it. And, you know, there's something very, there's something very careful and intimate about paying that kind of attention to stones. I mean, it's like you see something and it catches your eye and, you know, you might kind of like offer it, you know, for the evaluation of whoever you're with. And sometimes they're wet and they're a little bit more clear. But a lot of times, it gets even more sort of intimate. I mean, that I hope I'm not, I mean, I think probably other people have done this, but what you tend to do is wet it. And what I tend to do is lick it. And, you know, and that'll bring out, like, the particular qualities of it. And not only that, it turns out, you know, we probably all know this, but we tend to forget it. Lots of these things have a particular flavor and a particular smell. And so I want to talk about Lucia a little bit. So Lucia, I mean, not so much, but, you know, thinking about how that particular kind of exchanged work, you know, that's had this kind of ongoing, you know, it became part of what I do, how I live my life. And, you know, she wasn't, she didn't tell me anything. She didn't really exactly convey anything, but there was a kind of communication that happened there. And the way it worked was not to give me information, but to sort of wake me up, as it were, to sort of an alertness to things, particular kind of things, that had always been there. But, you know, we grow up and we get involved with other things, and we forget certain kinds of things. So the point is that she didn't, like, teach me something. She, through her expression of herself being a child, sort of brought up for me something that was had always been there, just sort of put aside. And that's not so unlike, really, what happens in the expression of our tradition when we, you know, encounter, you know, the Dharma, and when we interact with teacher and Sangha, those kinds of things. You know, of course, we get information about this or that, but it's mostly a matter of, you know, Taigen or the Dalai Lama, whoever it is not going to give you Buddha nature. There may be something through your interaction that will allow you to sort of see that, to become awake to what's already there. And so in that sense, you know, I mean, Dogen sort of says at one point, I think in the Genjo Koan, that fully realized Buddhas do not necessarily notice they're Buddhas. And, you know, I don't want to say that Lucia was a fully realized Buddha. There's a difference between that and the openness of a child. But there was kind of a Buddha function there. There was this kind of awakeness that then is transmitted. You know, nothing really is exchanged, but somehow there is this communication that wakes somebody else up a little bit in a particular kind of way. Also, not so unlike this collection of stones and what happens when we, you know, examine them closely. The main way we, you know, we do all kinds of things here, but the main, it's not even a tool. It's not even really a vehicle. But what we do when we come to a place like this is we do zazen. And zazen, you know, each sort of moment, you know, we're presented with something. You know, they come one after another. You know, the situations of our lives, you know, as we're sitting here, you know, expression of wisdom and delusion and desire and dislike and love, all those things, they come up. And part of what we do in zazen is, there's a lot else that could be said about it, but one of the things that we do is just have that same kind of tuning in to what is the quality of this moment, this time, this place, in this life, in this mind, this body, all those things, and then just, you know, and we, rather than letting it pass, we're there with it completely. And it's not, it's a little different than the stone thing, because, like, with a stone, you know, there is that intimacy. Like I said, you can taste them and you look at them and stuff like that. But, you know, this thing about thinking about things and looking at things, it has this appropriate sort of distancing. The senses of taste, smell, and touch, they're not somehow out there. They're much closer to home. And so when we sit in zazen, you know, we don't exactly, we're not looking at our lives, we're not thinking about our lives, but we are feeling it, and we're tasting it, and we're smelling it. You know, and as Taigen says all the time, you know, it's like, you know, how does it feel? How does it feel? How does it feel? It's so close, and it's so intimate, and there's a quality of, you know, we have all this other stuff we other ways we talk about our experience in our practice, one of those being the paramitas, the six virtues or whatever, which I think can be seen as both the sort of means, the practice of generosity and energy and discipline, patience, meditation, wisdom. Those things can be seen as the sort of what we do to wake ourselves up. But at the same time, they're exactly the fruit, the expression of wakefulness. As Dogen, Suzuki Roshi, Taigen, everybody points out, it's like we don't meditate to become awake. We meditate as an expression of that already there. So, thinking about the paramitas and this thing of like, I'm trying to like explore this little metaphor of of zazen and close examination of something in particular. I think of particularly the first one, dana, generosity, and I'm sure you could do this with all the others, but in the situation of looking at a stone or holding our lives and the lives of other beings in our mudra and having it close in, there's this expression of dana, of generosity, just in the sense that to do that, you have to sort of stop experiencing the world as an echo of yourself, sort of this seeing everything through our own particular greed, hate, and delusion. We sort of settle down, and as Dogen says, the 10,000 things come forward and experience themselves, including us as one of the 10,000 things. So, this phenomenal expression of, and just giving the space for things to come up in that way, and to allow yourself to be present in that way is very fundamentally a kind of generosity. It's letting things simply come as they go, come and go as they are, and accept them and be grateful for them. So, without making a lot of fuss or storyline about it. So, just to hammer the metaphor home, we're talking about these little rocks, and I sort of talked about the sort of Buddha aspect and the Dharma aspect, and of course we can elaborate these things further. So now I want to sort of twist the thing about stones a little more and talk about the Sangha aspect. There's a metaphor that's used a lot in Zen circles about Sangha, and it's a good metaphor, but it's this thing of, and it came up very recently here, of as people who practice in a Sangha, we sort of bump up against each other, and our edges get sort of smoothed out, and we get polished, and we learn to function well together. And a visual expression of that would be something like this, which is a very round kind of stone. That's a very beautiful sort of metaphor, but there are all kinds of stages of it. There's like something like this, it's not round, it's really smooth. But I would like to emphasize another way of looking at Sangha, which is, there's a way, going back to this idea of generosity and just letting things be as they are and come as they go. That includes people too. And, without sort of contradicting the earlier sort of thing about smoothing things out, there's an aspect of Sangha that simply allows us all to be here truly as ourselves with whatever qualities we have, you know, which are, they're very different. I think about there's a stone wall at Tassajara. It's beautiful. It was being extended and rebuilt when I was there. And the whole way that wall worked was not by chiseling down the stones and getting rid of the particularities and rough edges, but instead, you know, very carefully and attentively, like putting them together and figuring out how do these fit together. Does this one fit here? Does it fit there? There was this cohesiveness and this real beauty, but it had everything to do with not smoothing things out, but with finding a way and a place for the stones that were being used to be exactly as they were. And there's so many ways to kind of think about this and talk about this, but Suzuki Roshi says things like Buddha becomes Buddha when you become you, to become a Buddha is to become a complete human being, and vice versa. There's this idea that we don't have to sort of, we shave our heads and wear certain things, we practice in a certain way here together, and there, you know, that's all as it is, and there is the rounding stone effect. But at the same time, part of what happens with this is that the particular qualities of each of us and of each day that we're here also come out. So, you know, I was noticing when Aishin came in this morning, I noticed this yesterday, it was like somehow I noticed the quality of her eyes in a different way than I used to with, you know, when she had hair. You know, I wasn't conscious of being like into your hair in particular, but I just wasn't seeing your eyes in the same way. And so, now we're both kind of bald-headed, but, something particular is highlighted. So to, with this idea of letting each stone sort of be how it is, I want to come back to my humble, but quite nice, Okesa envelope. The story of this Okesa envelope. My younger sister, Thuy Lien, as many of you know, is a priest at San Francisco Zen Center. And so she had sewn me an Okesa envelope, and one for Nancy as well, when we were there. You know, wonderful and very beautiful, beautiful thing, beautiful object, and sort of carefully, I think, chosen for me, the materials and so on. But she's a much smaller person than I am, and it turned out it was a bit too small. And so as we were, preparing for our ordination, you know, getting things together, it's like once I, finished sewing the Okesa with Hoketsu, it turned out that it didn't really quite fit in there. I really had to bunch it up. And, but it was this sort of beautiful thing. And, sort of the end of the story, well, it's not ending until I find my rock, but the, Yan gave me this thing as an expression of herself, and that, her particularity, the particularity of our relationship, which has not always been easy, and, but it didn't quite work, but it was like this beautiful thing, and Hogetsu was like, oh, this is gorgeous, beautiful, 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 and I'm in a situation of needing a, didn't want, kind of in the last days to have to sew an envelope for myself, and so we traded, and so like now Hogetsu has this beautiful Okesa envelope that came as an expression of my sister, and hits close to home with you know, what Hogetsu, as her particular being, finds beautiful. And then I get this other really beautiful thing that comes with, you know, it's not only something to kind of put my okays in, but it's got like this history. You know, it's been used by other practitioners that I know, and I mean, I don't know the full story of it and everything, but it's like, you know, so there's like this way in which I think this is an expression of Sangha as just kind of everybody sort of, you know, being very different people, but being themselves and having it, you know, become this kind of like, you know, exchange. And again, you know, with this idea of Dana, like we do the meal chant, there's like, you know, there's no particular sort of identifiable, you know, we can talk about the sequences of people and stuff, but, you know, giver, receiver, and gift, just kind of in that kind of thing, get they're the same, you know. It's just this sort of like beautiful expression of something that happened, and it's not like, you know, it's not like a set of like, well, here I am, I'm the giver, you're the receiver, and then you go around, and you know, it's just that it doesn't feel like that to me. And there's this kind of, you know, and so I'm going to find this rock, and there's going to be this sort of mixing, and you know, and that will be with me every time I take out my okesa. And it's sort of a humble thing, but it's like, you know, it's like, wow, I really appreciate that. So, you know, this is kind of meandering, and that's really all I've got to say, but thank you for your patience on my talk, and thank you for your patience on everything else, and, you know, thanks very much, and if anybody's got any comment, that'd be great.
I just wanted to thank you for a really lovely talk and very, you know, intimate and spontaneous, as well as I've been looking at the rocks that you have, and when you were talking about difference and sameness, I really, you know, resonated in a different way, because when I'm you know, looking at these rocks up close, and I don't know what it must look like, you know, maybe from way back along there, they maybe look more the same actually, but sitting right up next to them, they are really all quite different, and you know, as I think you were pointing out, each beautiful in their own way, and I think it gave me a chance to think about how we are all like that too, and as Sangha, we are you know, the same, and maybe when we kind of come at each other from a distance, there's a way in which we're the same, and then when you get right up close and examine each one, you know, we're each very different in a lot of different ways, and that maybe goes in with the rock tumbler metaphor.
Yeah. I mean, I could pass them around, or people can look later. But yes, that's exactly what I was trying to.
And that kind of fits with the okesa as well. The envelope, you know, I know that some envelopes fit some okesas and some don't. And I think I especially noticed that with all of our okesas, that they are really the same. You know, and you know, kind of, I think it was Suzuki Roshi who talks about, it's not until you all put on your robes that I can see how different you are. When you're wearing all your different clothing, you all look the same. But when you put on the robes, there's something about the difference that's highlighted. And it's really highlighted when you talk direct, you know, up close about the okesa, in which it is custom fitted to your particular dimensions. And, you know, the three-finger width or the two-finger width, everyone's is a little bit different in that way. So thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Laurel.
thanks so much for telling the story of Lucia. It reminded me of very, very warm memories I have of my own daughter, who's a grown woman now, but who always helped us look at things and made us carry sacks of rocks. She would find them, but we would carry them.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I mean, they were very particular to her, and that helped us understand how particular they were. And she's now an artist, and I think that was a worldview that she had from the time she was born, to look at things in a very particular way and experience them the way an artist does. So, thank you. We still have some of those rocks.
I bet most people here have a few rocks stashed away in some drawer somewhere. Don.
So, most surfaces in our house are covered, so it's not just a few, it's weird. But we move with boxes of rocks and fossils and sticks and, you know, all the stuff that you find. And we've been practicing lately with not taking as much, you know, because we do tend to, you know, be like, oh my gosh, look at this wonderful thing, and, you know, and how much are we going to keep taking? Because then I noticed, how much do I take from people, you know, and how much do I take just in general, you know, of these beautiful things that I think, you know, and I don't know. But I do totally appreciate the rocks. And I'm already, like, just totally oogling, like, looking at the rocks, like, whoa, those are cool.
You know,
And even last night, like, I was looking at art that was made out of sea glass, because sea glass I never knew about until I moved here. And so all I ever find are these little tiny pieces, and I have this one little pile. And so at Amory, she looks for sea glass for me, and I have this one little pile. But then I've seen, like, sea glass pieces that are, like, huge. And I think it's a neat thing, and it does make you appreciate just the very, and, like, I know I have pieces too of rocks that have, like, holes, like, and I know I have them, and I know which ones they are. I can picture them in my head.
You say you have rocks with holes and point to your head with
them. Well, no, I can picture them in my head. Which ones they are, because there aren't very many that you find, like, rocks that have, you know, so
yeah.
Kind of a really cool thing. And it's cool that you remember that about that. And hopefully you can remember that about other people, too, each person's uniqueness.
No, it's interesting, you know, thinking about, you know, you're talking about having, like, lots and cutting back and everything. So there is this process of picking and choosing at a certain point. But I bet, you know, if you, like, you know, went to your daughter and said, well, let's, you know, this one's kind of plain, let's just get rid of that. That's one of my favorite ones, you know. You know, there's not another one like it. And, you know, the other thing I think about, you know, going back to this thing about Zazen and the difference between this kind of thing, because there is, you know, there's a line, the great way is not difficult, just, you know, avoid picking and choosing. And, you know, with these, you know, it's painful and it's difficult sometimes, but, you know, there were times there would be a big, you know, pile, and you know, Lucia's mother would be, you're not taking all those home, you know, there's no way. And so there is this picking and choosing, and that's not the same as what happens in the sort of moment after moment in our Zazen, because you know, our past and our future are always sort of gathered completely into that moment, and we will carry it with us. It is karma, you know, and you know, which of course means each moment not only is unique and precious, but we're called upon to respond to it in a way that, you know, it's this idea of vow, like, because the life we live is the one we will continue to live, and yeah, I mean, it's just, and so moment after moment, you want to take good care of that, because that's, you know, if you're going to wake up that's going to be the time and the place, you know. I mean, so you don't have quite that same capacity to be able to, like, leave it behind. And you wouldn't want it. Yes?
Yeah, I wanted to bring up something and sort of thank you a little bit for whatever difficulties you had in the beginning of the morning. Ogetsu could definitely say this, that I don't really show precision very much in my practice. And I've seen it, you know, when I first started in Zen, this doesn't come natural to me. I remember, you know, I've seen people that it just does. You know, they can learn a ritual and boom, 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 in 5 minutes they're, you know, far ahead of where I am now. And so it's interesting to watch that. And that, I think, has something to do with the stones, the difference of people within the Sangha. You know, there's a comment about the Buddha having horses that,
oh, yeah.
You know, that speed, and others that take a little bit of training.
Yeah.
So it was nice, in my own way, I guess, in my own awkward way. It was nice to see that. And it also brought up a koan I worked at one point. It was called The Last Word with Tokusan. It's in Momenkan. And Tokusan is this experienced teacher. And there was sort of this young pup student who says, you know, hey, this wasn't time to do this. And Tokusan just went on and took the correction very well. I don't know that I would ever do that quite so humbly, but it's something about it, the way I think practice should be. So that all came up for me.
Thank you. I mean, it's interesting. It's like, you know, in my particular case, you probably witnessed a lot of that because it's not as low. You know, I hadn't had people sort of explain to me the process like 3 times this morning, and I still couldn't, like, you know. But, you know, this thing about, you know, you're talking about the sort of smoothness and grace through which some people can go through all of the things you see at a Zen center. You know, I would not be surprised to find that, in fact, in many of those situations, it's not that people know it inside and out. They might do this or that in a slightly different way or get a little bit confused, but you know, that they have this, they develop this kind of presence where even so, you know, they can stay with it and do it gracefully and elegantly and everything works. I mean, if you see what I'm saying, it's like, I think that maybe people come to be able to make mistakes well as opposed to awkwardly. We'll find out, you know. Thank you.
I always thought that Zen practice, more I practice it, it's the art of making a mistake. And I thought it was very appropriate, felt very good to me that we could play with your sangha together. You know, that's how you learn, taking that, receiving the instruction. But also I was, you know, receiving the memory of what it was like to unfold my sangha for the first time in this kind of situation. Huh. I think they're there to help me. So I recall, so it was kind of nice. But I do remember being taught, you know, by many people, whenever I go to temples still, I ask for instruction on how do you do that with your sangha? How does that work? Yeah, could you fold that a little differently? But everything. And so it's that receiving that I find is part of sangha. And we actually experience that with everyone all the time here. Whether I'm serving UT or just hanging out, walking kinhin or sitting, that I feel that support. It's that elegance that you talk about doesn't come from somebody knowing the form perfectly, but it comes from receiving the harmony with the sangha, I think. Mm-hmm. And if there's resistance, I know I can feel when I have resistance to that, like, you know, oh, I don't want to see that. then for sure, it doesn't work very well. So. So thank you for noticing the particularity of our situations.